Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are Blunting Blades in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Yes, that's right, it was another five-star return from our second trip to Bramall Lane this year, with our returning African champion Simon Adingra helping himself to a brace. It was a win that lifts us to seventh in the table ahead of Everton's trip to the Amex on Saturday. The Toffees 5-1 win in the corresponding fixture last season will still be burning a hole into Zerbi's psyche and he will be hungry for revenge. However, Everton are without a win in eight and should be hearing if their points deduction appeal has been successful this week. But it's all right, Everton fans. Dr. Brighton will see you now. In other news, in a move similar to giving a monkey a typewriter, Chelsea have recruited Albion's head of recruitment again, with Sam Jewell heading to Stamford Bridge after a spot of gardening leave. And then on Friday, we get to find out who our opponent will be in the Europa League round of 16. Joining me today is, as ever, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back Nick Trepanic. Welcome back, Nick. Lovely to see you. You all right?
Yeah, it's lovely to be seen. Yes, looking forward to it.
It's an exciting week finding out who our opponent is going to be.
Yes, absolutely. People are just worried that it's going to be a trip to Karabag or somewhere, but I have a Galatasaray feeling about it.
Do not say that to me, because this is the thought of Wilf coming to the Amex for another team.
Listen, it still could be Marseille.
I just think Istanbul is just such a fantastic city to visit. I'd love to see Albion fans get a chance to go over there and see the team play. But there's some great trips. Lisbon, fantastic. Freiburg, very interesting. I don't know. We'll see. It's all good.
Actually, well, we'll come on to that in a little bit. But first, let's start with welcoming home, Nick, an African champion, because I don't believe we've had one before.
No, it was great stuff. It was an interesting final as well. You know, obviously, those of us, we're all behind Cote d'Ivoire, and a bit of a shocker when Nigeria went ahead. But no, our man did the business with a well hit corner, and then tremendous piece of skill for the winning goal. I think people quite rightly focused on Allah's finish off his studs, but. It was a cross that just begged someone to stick it in the net, whether it was a friend or foe, and it happened to be friend. So, great stuff. Lovely little take past a Premier League footballer right back, or may not be a Premier League footballer after this season if we hear about Nottingham Forest's chances of avoiding a point deduction are true. But, great. And obviously loved to see all the celebrations and not quite on the same level as Ali Mack's World Cup celebrations. But our boys seem to be having a great time and good for him.
Yeah, I suspect that he's also going to get a similar welcome to a full Amex this time on Saturday.
I think it was nicer that his return coincided with the Open Day, and it was good that the club gave him a nice welcome like that. So, I would hope that the Amex, I don't know if Everton will give him a guard of honour, but perhaps, I don't know if Premier League protocols will allow that, because you know, there has to be a certain way of coming out the tunnels together and that. But, I'm sure you'll get a rousing reception when Richie Reynolds reads his name out.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think the worst that the club could do is actually just repeat what they did for McAllister. I mean, he was introduced to the crowd sort of 10, 15 minutes before kickoff. Another ticker tape thing. Thankfully, he didn't repeat the cheesy, here's a replica World Cup, please lift it, because we know that we'd like to have done it. But yes, he's still got that rousing applause. But actually, just you asking the question and Nick's response just sort of made me think a little bit. Let's just take a step back from this. And I know this is a subject that we've talked about many, many times over the past sort of year, 18 months, 2 years, is that this is now the second, well, one was a global champion. This one's a continental champion. And who knows, we could be welcoming back a European champion, you know, sort of the next season. You know, if Lewis Dunk actually is allowed on the plane to Germany, who knows? But my point would be is,
well, don't forget Pascal Gross.
Pascal Gross.
Gross. But Germany are not that great at the moment, except
well,
in tournaments.
Well, you know, Gross could be in the squad. Undav could be in the squad. We could have two.
Yeah, I know. But, yeah, I mean, the chances of Undav's return are slim. But that's not my point. My point is that look at the zeitgeist. Look at the era, the epoch that we're living in as Brighton fans that, I'm not saying we're not getting blasé. I mean, we're all delighted for Simon Adingra, but you think of the number of clubs that have had continental champions before playing for them, and they just get welcomed back. It's almost as if they're obliged to win their continental tournament. But here we are, Ickle, Brighton and Hove Albion, and we're welcoming back these heroes, and it's, you know, one per year. And this is the sort of stuff that, you know, rewind that 2-3 years ago. I mean, and I still hearken back to the starting point of it being the last of those six defeats in a row, and then we beat Arsenal. So it starts there. That since then, the trajectory has been stratospheric. And here we are supporting Brighton and Hove Albion, not expecting our players to come back, but isn't it brilliant that they do come back with their national team honouring them in such a way? I mean, it's one of those things where, like, say, 2-3 years ago, you wouldn't have considered it. You'd like to have dreamed, but it doesn't work that way. You know, when you're 6 years old, you dream of lifting the FA Cup, you dream of lifting the World Cup, but it ain't going to happen. But by the time you get to your 50s and 60s, you still dream of it. And if it can't be you, then it's someone that you are sort of emotionally and socially sort of close to, and some a Brighton player. And if there's someone like that who can do that, it's just absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. Yes, I can remember the days when we were mildly gutted that Gary Chivers didn't actually get to play for Malta. but I still got the We've Got a Maltese International T-shirt.
Yeah. But Nick, I mean, we were saying on the show last week, actually, about Simon and the fact that prior to him going away to the tournament, obviously he picked up an injury and he didn't start in the first few games in the tournament, that he was actually beginning to look a little bit tired. I mean, he's one of the few players that was actually starting every game. But he's actually come back and he actually seems to be rejuvenated.
Yes, it's almost as if the prospects of playing in the later stages of a major international tournament, you know, was quite a motivating force, but an inspiring force as well.
You're being cynical, Nick.
Good for that. I mean, we were concerned about Adingra and Mitoma when they went away, and thinking, oh, you know, are they going to return our players slightly damaged, you know, through wanting them to play when they're not fully fit and they wouldn't be playing for us? But it's turned out very well. I mean, Mitoma didn't show any ill effects whatever of his trip back to Asia. Quite the reverse, in fact, at Bramall Lane.
Well, it turns out that Mitoma didn't actually have to go away to get slightly damaged.
Despite the best efforts of Sheffield United, Mitoma at the moment is unbreakable.
Let's move on to that anyway, then. Sheffield United, it was a first clean sheet for Bart Verbruggen, actually, in the league from him starting. Adingra came back in, and there was also a rare start for Adam Webster in this one. It was when I was watching this game, Nick, I just felt, I mean, United started well. Bart Verbruggen was tested early on, but we never really had to get out of first gear, did we?
No, not really. It was, as they say, the save you'd have expected any goalkeeper to make, and he did well to put bat it sideways rather than back into the path of a forward. You mentioned the team selection, which I thought was a little bit odd, actually. Webster right back ahead of, you'd think, Veltman, if you wanted to play that sort of back three stroke back four option. Interesting that Estupiñán didn't get the nod ahead of Lamptey until Lamptey got the booking. So that Lamptey on the left, that was an experiment that was continued. I wonder whether he'd picked the team with a particular Sheffield United lineup in mind. And I think the fact that Webster came off at half time, despite, you know, having played pretty well as far as I could see, showed that that had been the way he looked at it. He'd picked a team to play Sheffield United, and when they went down to 10 men, he could change it, and we could play with a bit more freedom.
Yeah, because not only does after 12 minutes is Sheffield United's game plan out the window, the Albion's is to a certain extent. well, to a part extent. I mean, you can still play the same way, but then there are ways in which, I mean, when they talk about 11 against 10, oh, you only beat 10 men. Well, that's neither here nor there. At the end of the day, it's not as though anyone's cheated. You know, the referee's not cheated, and it's not as though the Albion have actually just sort of sneakily, you know, sort of taken someone off the pitch. It was all within legitimately the laws of the game. So we've been terrible against 10 men now. Hang on. Well, it's 10 men, and there are ways of playing against 10 men. And I think this is the first time that, ideally, that we've done so. Although I think Sheffield United, in that sense, actually did fall into our hands. That said, we have in the past had problems getting past teams who've, well, they call it a low block. I call it parking the bus. but that we've had troubles against them. And I think that one thing that does help us is that Sheffield United, as decent as they are going forward, their defence is a mess. And I'd say a bigger mess than ours. And ours is far from brilliant, our defence.
We've had fewer problems against low blocks since we've had wingers, I think. You know, because they pulled the block wide, or they can do. I was very entertained by Chris Wilder taking off their only forward and playing four sort of 4-4-0 formation. I thought that was great, because the damage limitation that he wanted to try and put in place. I think the plan wasn't it to, I think he admitted to try and keep the score down and then have a go with 10 minutes to go, 10 minutes left. But of course, that all went out the window when their guy rather obligingly stuck the third past his own keeper.
Yeah, I'll say it's like you say, we didn't get our first, second gear, whatever way you want to put it. But there are times when we've played against poor sides, and poor sides are there to be beaten. We've played against poor sides, and we've played poorly against them. And I'm thinking, you know, the games at home, like against Burnley, against Sheffield United, against Fulham, that we should have really tucked away and didn't. And this time round, we controlled it. Like I say, I think Sheffield United did actually fall into our trap a little bit. I think Chris Wilder, you can argue maybe Chris Wilder should have been a little bit more ambitious, but would we have picked him off to get 6, 7 and 8? Who knows? I mean, that's fantasy stuff. But
I think it wouldn't have been the first side to score eight there this season.
Even though they went down to 10 men, I don't think that even if they had 11 on, their first two goals would have made much difference, because the defending was itself poor. It's not because they had 10 men. It's because collectively they were a shambles in the box.
Well, we wouldn't be the first side to go there and score eight this season. So it's, you know, they're not a great side. I mean, I think from a Blades perspective, they probably did get promoted a year, 2 years too early, because I mean,
really invest. The owner didn't seem like somebody who was determined to put some money in to keep them up there. Because
they sold the best two players.
Yeah, they're one of the weakest teams. You know, they're not quite Derby County weak. Going back, you know, a decade or so, they were another team that didn't expect to get promoted, probably didn't deserve to get promoted, but you know, weren't going to say no after winning a playoff final. And no, United looked terribly ill-equipped. I can't see. I suppose they've got to play out the rest of the season. Everyone else has got a chance to score a load of goals against them. But, you know, I suppose they would have felt pretty good about that game, having won at Luton, which I don't think a lot of people saw coming.
I mean, the cautionary tale is already there for other clubs. So wonderfully chronicled in a fantastic book called Brighten Up. The author's name escapes me. But yeah, I mean, if we'd have gone up that season where we missed out in the playoffs against Sheffield Wednesday on that day against Middlesbrough, I can't help feeling that our relegation would have been not that much more certain, but I think that it would have been such an upward curve in order to stay in the Premier League.
Because I always think that the Middlesbrough team that didn't beat us, that drew against us, got relegated straight away and didn't really justify its promotion, didn't really put up much of a fight, couldn't score goals. They were an appallingly dull team. So, looking back on it, I think the extra season didn't do us any harm. We scored loads of goals. Mm-hmm. Glenn Murray, you know, came back and did the business in the grand style, and we looked a much more well-equipped team when we did go up.
Yeah. That's exactly the point I was going to make. Well, okay, but let's get back to this game then, and we've already alluded to it, but the 13th minute there, Al, Mason Holgate,
He's got
he won't want to
previous,
see it
isn't
again, will he?
he? He's well, he, well, the rest of the Sheffield United team need to, if the captain's attitude is anything to go by. You can't actually work out what's going on in his head. Apart from, maybe the point that Alan Shearer made on Match of the Day, which was, yeah, you want to get an early smash in. But if you're going to get an early smash in on Mitoma, you've got to really time it properly because he's past you before you know it.
But in this day and age, do you, let the guy know you're there, really, with VAR? I don't know. That's Alan Clark used to let the goalkeeper know he was there early on in games. But, that, I think that's one of the things that VAR's taken out of the match. Something as blatant as what we assume Holgate was trying to do, that mistime it though he did. I don't know. It was just grotesque.
Yeah,
I mean,
I mean,
the
it
really
wasn't a reducer, was it? It was
well, it was damn near a mincer.
It was an amputator, but no,
it was. I mean,
lucky
it's
his leg
all.
wasn't planted.
Well, that's the point I was about to make. I mean, Mitoma was so lucky that it wasn't half a second later that either A, his foot wasn't on the ground, or B, more than that, he had his entire weight on it. I mean, at the time of impact, his all his weight was on the other leg. But if it was on that leg, then it's, sayonara, mate. Because you, I mean, his knee would have ended up in row Z while the rest of him is crumpled on the ground. What actually happens? I mean, whether the Premier League or the FA are going to get involved with a foot more than 3 match ban. I mean,
I don't think they can.
well, they can. There is precedent for it, certainly. I mean,
It's
remember Ashley
serious
Barnes, for
foul play.
instance.
It's the three. It's a 3 match ban, and I don't think many people will worry about not seeing Mason Holgate again. Some of the Sheffield United fans, well, they were booing Mitoma during the game, but I think almost all of them have seen the error of their ways since, and
Most
would
of them at half time.
quite cheerily send Holgate back to Everton.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't it be a shame if we had to play against him this weekend? But as it is, he's suspended. But yeah, I get the feeling that certainly a lot of Sheffield United fans saw the footage, on their respective phones and what have you, at half time. Because again, watching the game, there was nothing like the same level of booing for him. But when you got the likes of Paddy Power on online coming up and saying Mitoma being roundly booed by the Sheffield United fans for nearly having his leg snapped in two.
Well, I mean, Carew. He made a classic mistake there of getting his leg in the way of somebody's flying foot.
Well, this is it. I mean, it's when you see where his foot landed, even if he'd have won the ball, you just think, how on earth does your leg end up there? And like I say, we could actually sort of be incredulous about it. I mean, many column inches have already been written, many words have already been spoken on various media outlets and what have you. And there's nothing really we can add apart from good riddance to bad rubbish. Yes, it helped us. Would we have won up there? Very possibly, but certainly he made our job, the Albion's job, a lot easier and made, or rather, made Sheffield United's job a lot harder in a way which I think that Chris Wilder himself could have arguably done a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, Nick, there's a lot's been made of the fact that the ref didn't give a straight red card for it; gave a yellow first off. But I mean,
I don't know. I mean, it depends on the angle you're at. It's an example of VAR working as it should.
yes.
The referee, I believe, was informed by his assistant that it was a bad challenge, and he obviously took that advice. But you didn't see how bad until he had a look at the monitor. There are angles. You can't be everywhere. You can't see everything, and that's why we have teams of referees and their assistants and VAR now, and it worked.
I mean, this
Okay.
is the point. So many people saying, oh, if we didn't have VAR, that would have been given as it remained as a yellow. Yeah, but we do have VAR. And I suspect, and it's not really worth speculating, but if VAR didn't exist, then the referee would be more inclined to give a red. But in either case, whether it's a yellow or a red that's given, then VAR can actually just sort of like turn it over one way or the other, whether the ref has made, quote, clear and obvious error. And a yellow card is a clear and obvious error here. But like you say, this is exactly what VAR is there for. So all the people saying, oh, what happens if it wasn't there? Well, it is.
Okay. Well, let's talk about goals, and we scored five of them. The first one, another one for Facu Bonarte.
No, we're not doing the song.
Oh, I rehearsed.
Go on, Nick. Go
no,
on.
No, no, no,
I'm
no.
I'm giving
no,
you permission.
No, really, let's spare the.
All I would say
that.
Is to our good friend Vicky Rees, start singing now.
But
he's,
I mean,
he's just become a goal machine, hasn't he? That's it's. That wasn't a part of his game that we, you know, we suspected was there really until recently. But I'm very interested to know what he was doing there, almost on the goal line. You know, the way you normally set up for attacking corners is to have the big guys in there, and the little guys you don't expect to get the headers will be sort of out, you know, there to collect the clearances. But great, you know, obviously one our fantastic preparation for attacking set plays has got the right guy in there at the right time.
Well, the weird thing is that the goal that we scored was exactly the same as the one we conceded, in as much as, you know, corner to the back post, gets nodded back by the big fella, and then come all the greyhounds to sniff it home. Luckily, we got, and we'll discuss it in a minute, luckily we got, you know, let off with that. But, you know, it's not the first time. Well, let's put it this way. Against Chelsea, we conceded two goals exactly like that. So as good as we are at one end of doing it, we're lousy at the other end.
But, I mean, and again, I mean, hasn't been worth us having a corner for a while, but that's twice recently we've actually scored from a corner, and actually looks like we've actually been. I mean, I know they work on them in training all the time anyway, but actually we're seeing some fruition from this now, and actually
Dunk pulling away at the far post. Of course, that worked at Tottenham last season, didn't it? When yes. He scored, so yeah, he's never. Doesn't know when he's when to give up on those very deep corners. He'll chase them, and when he gets them back, yeah, they're very effective.
Okay. It's just that when he's in the middle, he is a 50p head.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to talk about the other goals in a minute, but I do just want to talk about this because I do think I'm just trying to work out on what planet Matoma getting clearly pushed over in the penalty box isn't actually a penalty.
On the count that we're on 5-0, I can't get excited about it. Above and beyond that, I've no idea.
It wasn't it wasn't the hardest push I've ever seen.
Does it have to be?
It doesn't have to be, but I don't know. The referee might have been in two minds as to whether he fell over rather easily, whether it was the hands on his back that made him go over, or whether he helped himself on his way or not. Because we're on 5-0, it wasn't controversial, but I've seen it not given, shall we say.
It's one of those that if it was given, it probably wouldn't have been turned over either.
It's a penalty. It's a penalty with day long. Even without my blue and white striped spectacles on, that's a penalty all day long. I've got no idea how it wasn't given. But fortunately for us, Danny Welbeck was on hand to make it 2-0. And Danny Welbeck has now played more games and scored more goals for Brighton than any of his other clubs, which I'm delighted to say.
And in a shorter space of time.
Not about the time bit, but yeah.
Well, I think it's 3.5 years with us. I think it was about 6 years at Man U, was it? Or it was a fair amount of time at other places, but yeah.
Are we including European goals in his total for Manchester United? For some reason, I thought he'd still score more for them because of the European goals. He scored more league goals, I think.
Yeah, for league. I think you're right, Nick. It is for Europe, and if you throw in all the other cup competitions, then yes, he's more than. But in terms of the Premier League only, yeah, he's scored more for us than he did for Man U or for Arsenal.
Yeah, well, fantastic. I can't remember, but I have a feeling I might have given an opinion on a well-known fan message board site that he was unlikely to be the sort of player we'd be interested in. And whether he would be any good after that appalling sojourn at Watford. But I don't know, sometimes you're delighted to be proved wrong. In fact, if I did actually say all those things.
Well, I think that probably you had history on your side when you were trying to make that opinion, Nick. But I think there's also the fact that, you know, those stats for a quote centre forward don't look great. But he is greater than the sum of those sums because...
Yeah, no, I mean, if you look at he was fairly prolific for England, but actually if you look at some of the teams he scored against, you know, San Marino and Rochdale Reserves and all that, it was some of the opponents weren't the best, and you'd expect him to have scored quite and padded his stats against some of those opponents. But as you say, no, he's more than a goal scorer. And we're very glad to see that, because obviously when they put Ferguson on with Welbeck, you you think, well, I don't suppose they're going to be a dual centre forward. I imagine, Welbeck will drop into the number 10 role, and he's looked very good when he's done that.
Absolutely, but also I think there's the off-pitch stuff as well. There is you mentioned Ferguson. There's also that kind of arm around the shoulder sort of thing that he has about teaching him the tricks of the trade, about sort of, he's got 10, 12-year start on him. And it's like that with Lallana. I mean, there's the senior pros of Lallana, Welbeck and Milner, who you can't help feeling have got not too long to go in terms of their career. And then you've got Gross and Dunk, who are probably only about 4 or 5 years left in their respective careers. It's possible that Lallana is going to hang up his boots at the end of this season. I mean, I think that the fact that he says, I'll make a decision at the end of the season, actually, I think is probably telling us what we're going to know or what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. But Welbeck's role is far more than just on-pitch stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Ferguson's actually said that Welbeck's helped him, and given him tips and, taking him under his wing. So, that's definitely happening. But, yes, he's also, very good with Tarik Lamptey and very funny as well. He's obviously, quite a dressing room wit.
Yeah, it's the father and son Cat Stevens style-y every time they turn up together. I think.
Oh yes, the parents' evening happy meal picture. That was brilliant.
That was genius. That was absolutely genius. Okay, well, I mean, it was another player that we've mentioned him already in dispatches, but that's for him getting his leg in the way of a boot. But this is also Kurt Mitoma's best performance for quite a while, I think.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, because we were sort of wondering whether he'd slightly gone off the boil before his injury and before the Asian Cup, but and the answering that foul in the best possible way by humiliating whoever else was put in his way, Bogle, wasn't it, most of the time? Showing absolutely no fear and no ill effects from the injury and. His setup for the own goal was very similar to Odingra's setup for the winning goal for the Ivory Coast in that African final. Yeah. So, you don't have to humiliate a fullback completely. You can just get a cross in quickly once you've made a yard, and he showed that in the best possible way.
Well, it's also that he managed to get past his man down to the byline more than once. I mean, that's the weird thing about that particular. It's great to look at, and you think, here he is trundling along the goal line. It's what it is from there, and the number of times he's tried to beat the keeper, who is standing sometimes almost in front of the post. It's a kind of a tactic that needs, I think, a little bit of expansion, because there's usually about three or four players waiting for the pullback, and he's trying to beat the bloke at the near post. I think it's maybe just this one particular game he was going for maximum humiliation after the lunge, the thigh high assault on him. Who knows? But yeah, the cross itself, absolutely delicious. I mean, he did the similar thing up at Everton when that came off whoever it did came off.
Ashley Young.
He is back to, well, certainly him and Odingra are back to better than they were before they got injured. And I suspect that possibly the injury itself may have been down to the fact that De Zerbi understandably used them for so many on-pitch minutes and they didn't get their rest.
Yes, absolutely. I think there's one other player, actually. I know we're praising the wingers and why not, but just a word about Pascal Gross's performance.
Oh, yeah.
There was a particular website that I quoted in my media roundup on the Albion website that had shown that he completed 97% of his passes. 97% of his passes, 113 passing attempts. It was described as a historically great passing day. 8 key passes, 9 accurate crosses. He keeps producing amazing stuff that we're almost taking for granted now.
Well, I think you could also see, certainly in the first half, I mean, Welbeck could have easily added to his total. He was the crosses were coming in, and we've known almost since day one when he turned up, Gross is probably the best dead ball player this club has ever had. And
he's invented that completely new right back inside left position as well that he played in the second half.
It's excellent.
And as for Johan Cruyff, I mean, his turn is only surely in his grave now, because that must be named after Gross now.
People, it depends on only the people underneath the radar. People above it, they wouldn't have a clue who he is.
The point is that
Ajax, long may that continue.
Ajax should rename their stadium the Pascal Gross Stadium.
Okay, well, Simon Dingra did actually score the goal of the game, turning in the aforementioned Pascal Gross's cross, which is a beautiful crisp finish, and then he made it five. I was actually hoping and praying that Evan Ferguson was actually going to get something on that, just so he could claim it and get the monkey off his back a bit. But
he was in the right position to do it. He didn't do it, but he'd got in there, so that's promising.
Yeah.
The point is that with Ferguson, I think that it's not, and I've said this before. You can say it with Welbeck as well. They shouldn't be judged by their figures of, oh, they've scored this many goals or that many goals. It looks great for Joao Pedro, absolutely, because he's got 19. But then so many of the penalties. The point is they still have to be stuck away. But I think it is also down to the fact that, A, his work rate is still good. He can still see he needs improving. His first touch away from the ball, is still needs improving. There are aspects of the game. For me, he is best as a 6-yard sniffer, but that's not necessarily the way we set up. But the other thing about it is that, and we're back to the whole notion of I'd rather have an 80 goal a season team than a 20 goal a season striker, given I'd rather have both. But he still makes a contribution, and like you say, but for the fact that he decided not to wave his foot any further forward than he did, it'd have got a goal. And it's a little bit, he probably sort of realized it himself, it's a bit churlish. He saw it as a Dingra's goal, let him have it.
Yeah, well, that's 67 goals for the season already. So,
have we really?
Yeah, all competitions. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. It was 105 during the calendar year, wasn't it?
Yes,
as per the YouTube video. That's a lovely one to watch. An hour and 40 minutes of us mucking about, but 67. Do you say that's
67 for the season so far in all competitions? Yeah.
Well, I think that even now, over our 120 years, and I did actually do, God, I'm a nerd when I'm bored, I did actually do a list of how many goals we scored in a season / calendar year. And certainly 105 is only second to 1956, where we scored something like 120. But yeah, we are in the realms of just scoring the most goals ever. And yet it still feels like we don't get enough.
Yeah, well, no, I certainly think there were 8 goals there for us to have scored easily, I think, at Bramall Lane on Sunday, but let's be happy with what we've got. I thought they were waiting to tire them out and go nuts in the last 10 minutes. And I suppose 2 goals in the last 10 minutes is slightly nuts, isn't it?
Yeah, but the most important thing here is, and let's not forget this, that's 38 points now. That is pretty much safety guarantees. We'll be in the Premier League again next season. Hurrah, so, we are Brighton after all. Let's celebrate those small things.
But the other stat that you said earlier in the show, actually at the top of the show, is not only is it another clean sheet, when I say another, it's only our third, but it's our first clean sheet that got us 3 points.
I'm all over that. And I'm also all over this, which is the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. You'll be amazed to hear that this show's brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and Phil has given us a lovely shirt to have a look at. And Nick, can you have a go at describing this particular jersey for me?
Looks like black sleeves and the body of black and pale gold stripes, with the sort of each gold stripe has a little black pinstripe down the middle of it. JMK are the sponsors. No idea who they might be. But the crest, although it's had anything that might give it away blotted out, shows 10 stars, 10 red stars. So either this is a very dominant team from a country's top division, or it's a team in the lower leagues that's gone mental, winning loads of slightly, shall we say, lesser titles or local leagues. So it could be a sort of Brazilian team in a local league that's won a lot or something like that.
Well, I'm looking at the thing is, what I'm looking at is what I mean, the shirt manufacturer is ATFC, so I'm just thinking, is that English? Who knows? There is one club that sprung to mind as soon as I saw it, and I'm thinking, well, if it's a club that's actually that dominant in its country. The one team that springs to mind is Peñarol. They wear yellow and black stripes, but
not even close.
Hang on, but what I'd also say is that in scratching out all the badge, Phil has just missed one word at the bottom, and it looks like it says rugby. Although it'd be the sort of, I'm just wondering if it's a kind of a sports and or football and rugby club or something like that. But
well, they play rugby in Argentina, don't they? And
yeah,
so,
but if AD says not, and Uruguay, close, in it's fact, probably not South America, is it? So
it's I can tell you what, it's definitely not South America.
Okay, fine.
you're suggesting it's closer to home then.
It's a lot closer than the South America, yes.
Okay, if the shirt manufacturer is anything to go by, where it says ATFC, and I'm sure it's got nothing to do with it, I'm just going to say Aberystwyth Town, okay?
Not far off, actually.
All right, okay.
Yeah.
It's not.
Oh, so is it?
And it is the wrong country, but...
Irish or...
Yeah. You're never going to get it.
Leinster or Ulster or...
Or Norway, or maybe Sweden, or could be Hungary, or maybe Italy, who knows?
I don't think they've ever made this a Lucio team of this particular one. But I'll put you out of the misery. And this is what Phil has to say. He says, here is your shirt of the week, chosen for no particular reason. This is the 2014-15 shirt of the West of Scotland Premier Division side, Auchinleck Talbot. The side was formed in 1909 and they play at the 4,000 capacity Beechwood Park, which is in Auchinleck, which is a town about 35 miles south of Glasgow. They take their name from Richard Wogan Talbot, who is the second Baron Talbot of the Malahide, and he's a local landowner who donated the land where Beechwood Park is built. Their nickname is The Bot. Talbot has spent most of their history... The Bot, yeah.
B-O-T.
B-O-T. Talbot.
Crying out loud.
Yeah. Talbot have spent most of their history in the Scottish Junior League, which they joined when they formed in 1909. The term junior refers to the level of football played, not the age of the players. They hold the record for the most Scottish Junior Cup wins with 14, and they've also won the Scottish Junior Premier League division on 7 occasions. One of the perks of winning the Junior Cup is entry into the Scottish FA Cup, which they managed to progress to the fifth round of in 2018. They beat Ayr United at home in front of a crowd of 3,100 fans in the fourth round. Their first ever victory over a full-time team. In the fifth round, they played Hearts at Tynecastle and in front of a crowd of 15,000, going down 4-0. In 2019, the club took the decision to leave the SJFA and joined the Scottish Pyramid System as one of the inaugural members of the West of Scotland Football League. And last season, they finished a creditable second in the West of Scotland Premier Division. Considering their illustrious history in Scotland's non-leagues, they've not been prolific at sending players through to the senior leagues. Striker Chris Doolan is probably the most high profile in recent times, moving from The Bot to Partick Thistle, where he made over 350 appearances and where he's been first team manager since last season. Another is Kurt Baldfoot, who played 80 times for Rangers and 70 times for Blackpool, as well as stints at Rotherham, Kilmarnock and Inverness Caledonian Thistle. A couple of links to Sussex. Steve Masterson spent 2010-11 with Crawley. He ended up in Auchinleck a year or so later. Defender David Wilson spent a year with Worthing in 94. He was with the Bot briefly in 2003. And there's a couple of links to like Gibraltar. And no links to the Albion, but he said he's still what he can do about that next week. So thanks for that, Phil. Of course, you can see that and over 130,000 other shirts over at oldfootballshirts.com.
So no clue what those 10 stars mean then?
No, nothing on here at all. But we'll ask,
lucky number.
I'm sure Phil will do some more digging for us and put that up on
the number of pints each player is obliged to drink after the game.
I'm in. I'm definitely in.
Yeah, okay, you'd be during the game.
I said at the top of the show how Chelsea they like giving monkeys to typewriters, and they've done it again by trying to nick our head of recruitment because it worked so well last time.
It's absolutely incredible. What was it? Was it Einstein that talked about the definition of madness? It's absolutely. I mean, what is wrong with Todd Bowley? what is wrong? I mean, this is a fellow who's come in. He's obviously, you know, had a history of American sports and realized that actually, well, still hasn't realized it works differently here. I mean, it's almost as if he's trying to buy us as a franchise. And he still hasn't worked out that actually, yes, we've got some very talented, very dedicated, very skillful people working in their various given roles. But what they don't realize is that it's the system, it's the setup that is key here. And that's not to say that you or I could just drop into that, into Sam Jewell's role and just do it because, but it's the setup. It's, you know, if they wanted Paul Winstanley, fine, great, have Paul Winstanley, but you're not getting all that data because Tony Bloom owns it. I mean, I don't know what it's kept in. Is it kept in a magic box? Is it on a particular laptop that no one else has access to? I mean, it's just, we'd like to think.
Magic box, I think.
Yeah, we'd like to think that it's something, you know, there's the cloud and then there's the real cloud. And this is where Tony, or whatever it might be, who knows, you know, buried somewhere along the River Ada. We don't know. But somewhere down the line, Tony owns the magic. The people who work at the club are those who put it into place. And as soon as they leave that particular castle, then the magic disappears and they're back to the tedious trudge of realizing they've actually sold their soul to work for the London Cowboys.
Don't forget, yeah. there's a slight sort of, there's a family issue here, isn't there? Because Paul Winstanley worked for Paul Jewell at Derby County as an analyst. And is now basically employed Paul Jewell's son, Sam, as his own sort of next in command. So there could be some sort of family stuff going on there. But, you know, as we know, that next man up, and Mike Cove is already installed, you know, doing the job that Sam Jewell did. And, the Albion system of preparing succession planning, you know, swung into action. Mike Cave's already there, got quite an impressive background. He was David Weir's assistant after joining from Fulham November 22. Obviously ready to step up. He was academy performance manager at Fulham after doing an internship with IMG for a long time. So, you know, he's got a lot of experience in the development side of football clubs at the top.
From what you're saying here, though, Nick, it sounds as though that Sam Jewell is leaving for almost a demotion here. One, he's going to Chelsea, snigger. But two, he's going from head of recruitment to not head of recruitment. So what's his motivation here?
Good question. Well, you know, as an Albion fan, I cannot possibly understand why anyone would leave the Albion to go anywhere. Was it Kid Creole and the Coconuts? When you leave New York, you go nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
when you leave New Monk's Farm, yep.
Yeah. I don't know. You'd be terribly cynical to think that Chelsea would offer more money. That maybe he was just, you know, bowled over by the project. Maybe that's, you know, he just dreams of winning things with Chelsea.
But the interesting thing here, I mean, because the other news story this week is obviously Dan Ashworth as well, and his proposed move to Manchester United, like Sam Jewell, he's also like tending to his garden.
But the point is, if Sam Jewell was going to be going to Manchester United, it would be Dan Ashworth that brings him in, and yeah. Dan Ashworth is on gardening leave and therefore can't make an offer until his gardening leave is up now. Actually, Nick, I just to one run something past you. It's David Ornstein is saying that there's a good chance that Sam Jewell won't be able to start at Chelsea until November. Mm. So is David Ornstein a good source?
Yes. Yeah, so I mean, there are some of my esteemed colleagues where you just think, oh, well, they've made that. No, made, I don't know. They've put two and two together and made five. But no, David Ornstein is pretty reliable. He's done very well for himself, and I think probably gone a lot further and become much a more significant figure than a lot of us suspected he might when he was coming through as a young writer. But you know, great credit to him, and I would take his word over certain other internet presences that
we could. I mean, it would also tie in with the length of gardening leave that Dan Ashworth was on when he left us to go to
you
Newcastle.
See, there was a question, you know, when there was people saying, "Oh, well, Dan Ashworth is going to go to Manchester United, and he'll want Sam Jewell." If you rated Sam Jewell so highly, why didn't you try and take him to Newcastle? I don't know. Maybe he did, and we didn't hear about it. But you know, there are. It didn't sound from quite early on that that Albion were going to do, you know, break the bank and offer Sam Jewell a huge pay rise to stay with us. It was okay. You want to go there? Fine. As I say, next man up.
Yeah,
Mike Jones, the man.
Yeah. Are you surprised, Nick, that Dan Ashworth has actually left Newcastle so early?
Well, I am, but that's because I loathe almost everything about Manchester United. And just as I can't understand anyone wanting to leave the Albion, I can't understand anyone wanting to go to Manchester United. And I suppose, you know, you look at the size of the club and everyone, I suppose, wants to work for the market leader. And some people who, you know, without particular club loyalties of their own, will see Manchester United as the market leader even now in English football. But, you know, all these people talk about what a great, you know, challenge it is to go to fill in name of club. And then, you know, once more money is waved at them, they'll go and talk about the even greater challenge at, you know, fill in name of even bigger club. And that would seem to be the situation.
But then, I mean, there does seem to be something that's not quite right at Newcastle at the moment in terms of...
I know that, you know, we laughed a little bit at Newcastle fans saying how awful it was, you know, that Mike Ashley had been, you know, what an awful way he'd run the club, essentially keeping them in the Premier League and getting them straight back up when they fell out of it. You know, lots of teams in three other divisions I can think of, we would love to have the sort of failure that Mike Ashley imposed on Newcastle United. But it is true that he didn't put an awful lot into club development, and that's where Ashworth's strengths are, you know, that working at developing the training ground, identifying areas of weakness and improving club structure. There's been an awful lot of stuff suggesting that he's, you know, he's going to buy this player and buy that player. That, you know, recruitment was something he was one of his responsibilities, but he wasn't a very hands-on recruiter. You know, he had a sort of overseeing role. So, you know, and you'd have to suggest that Manchester United's lack of success recently is probably down to them, their structures, and there'll be stuff he can do there. But I don't know. They've got so many other people who seem to be doing something similar. You've got Brailsford. You've got the guy they got from Manchester City. There's going to be an awful lot of the Chiefs to Indians ratio there is going to be quite something.
But I mean, you're talking about Man United there, of course. And actually, since Jim Ratcliffe's gone in there, they do appear to actually, oh, you can actually do this. This is how you run a football club. And it looks like they might actually be doing something decent there. But in regards to Newcastle and particularly...
Can I butt in there? And it's interesting you mentioned Jim Ratcliffe here. Obviously, sort of a multi-billionaire, one of the most, you know, the richest and most successful businessmen in the country.
But, Chelsea season ticket holder.
Even though sort of the Northwest is his home turf. But
he's from Oldham, isn't he?
Yeah, that neck of the woods. But my point would be is that therein lies an issue of before Tony Bloom took over at Brighton and Hove Albion, he had never run a football club before. Now, admittedly, his uncle and his grandfather have been on board, but that's a massive difference between what they were doing and what Tony intended to do. Now, he could get some help. But and it's, you know, and if you ask him and he'll give it, and if he's up for giving an honest answer, he'll tell you that he didn't get everything right. And I would imagine that probably in his first couple of years, you know, now, admittedly, we were about to move into the stadium and everything was focused on that. But, you know, not everything has gone swimmingly. In the last, like you say, 3-4 years, it certainly has. And it's shown. But my point was that actually only ever going to be Jim Ratcliffe, if he really wants to turn Manchester United round, has got to understand that he cannot be the big boss man. He's got to bring in people who know better.
Well, that appears to be what he's doing. I mean, it's like, I mean, Tony's strength is like if he doesn't know something, he finds somebody who can.
Well, absolutely.
Who does know. And that seems to be what Ratcliffe's doing there. But it just seems to be, but I mean, in regards
but
to...
But are you, like, you suggesting that Ratcliffe should come after Paul Barber?
Yes. He won't, and it won't happen, but...
I'm not suggesting that at all.
Well, this but, I mean, is why he'll want someone...
In regards to Ashworth, though, I mean, the whole situation, I mean, the, apart from the fact there seems to be a hell of a lot of revisionist journalism going on in regards to who everyone seems to think he signed for Brighton, even players who joined before he even got to the club.
You can thank Sky Sports for that little nugget, can't you?
It's ridiculous. But it just seems that Newcastle, the project, does seem to be slightly derailed a little bit at the moment. And I think that the whole... I mean, we're going to talk about Everton shortly and what's happening with FFP with them. It seems to be that they seem to be their owners can't spend all these millions of pounds that they've got.
Well, I think that the part of it might actually be is that do they have succession planning? Now, like I say, Tony can only throw so much at it, and in comparison to Newcastle, he can't throw as much as they can. But one of the reasons that we are that success is we have a relatively smooth transition. Even the jolt of losing Potter to getting De Zerbi, now we lucked out in as much as there were no games in between. But even that was seen as a relatively smooth transition. It was an evolution rather than a revolution. David Weir was brought in, who had been number two to Ashworth when he was here. There was that transition. I think that the thing that, whether the quote Newcastle project is derailed or not, is probably going to be judged by, do they have someone, a ready-made replacement, or are they going to have to go headhunting again?
There's a slight difference because Eddie Howe, by all accounts, is quite hands-on as far as recruitment goes. It won't be, you know, let's say Eddie Howe leaves or they replace him, there won't be such a smooth transition because there won't be a recruitment department that's separate from the first team coaches department. You know, that there will be presumably a completely different set of criteria and you know, ideas for targets if a new manager comes in, because there the manager has much more to do with recruitment than, let's say, at the Albion, where the recruitment department gives Roberto De Zerbi you know, a list of players that he wants, and you know, as they've done with all managers, and they only come into the process late on. So I think that, you know, Newcastle is running a slightly different way. But yes, I mean, that's their financial fair play restrictions are quite amusing, really, I suppose. You know, that every club has different issues and slightly different structures. And, you know, even call their, you know, the director of football or technical director different things at different places. And they started from quite a long way back, Newcastle, you know, with a poor training ground and not much in the way of, if you hear, you know, the scouting wasn't so great, the analysis wasn't quite so good. And Ashworth, I think his famous wheel, I think, had more spokes at Newcastle than it did at Brighton, because more needed doing when he got there.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, well, it's not our story, so we'll move on from that. But it's an interesting. I'd like to say we'd like to wish them luck, but we'd be lying. So let's move on. I don't want to spend too much time on it, Nick. But I mean, in regards to this weekend's opponents, Everton, they're hoping to hear this week if their appeal's been successful. We don't really want them to be given any motivation ahead of the game.
No, I was pleased that they equalised. Well, for many reasons, I was pleased they equalised against Crystal Palace. You wouldn't have wanted them to go into a home game with them, having lost to Palace and being even more desperate for points. As it is, you know, we know what they did to us last season. We know it's Sean Dyche. To some extent, we know what to expect, and we hope that Roberto has learned a lot from last season's debacle. And yeah, but Everton haven't got that many really good players at the moment. And the good players like Doucouré don't seem to be in particularly good form. I've heard that Calvert-Lewin is really struggling. So no doubt, you know, there's a hat-trick for him.
Thanks, Nick.
Yeah, that's on Saturday.
Thanks, Nick.
Well, you know, but we all know this, you know, so...
We all know this.
Everton will be a...
Dr. Brighton will see you now.
Any Dyche team coming down here, you know, is going to upset us. You know, Tarkowski is going to do what Tarkowski does against our attackers, and we hope that that Calvert-Lewin's lack of form continues.
Yeah, I mean, it's the nature of it, isn't it? I mean, I suppose that Sean Dyche is just one of those that he makes as best as he can sort of interesting, good to watch teams and drags them down to their level. I mean, even the game up there now, admittedly, It's the funny thing about this season is that I don't think people are in Albion fans are enjoying it as much as last year, despite the fact that A, we're in two cup competitions at this stage. Here we are, end of February, still in two cup competitions, one of which is European. But because we had this kind of brand new, exciting elevation up to sixth, and beating Manchester United and beating Chelsea and beating Arsenal and so on, I won't say that the luster has gone, but I think that the sort of the expectation has risen, and the excitement, the sort of like the childish excitement is slightly different. Because beating Everton, even up there at their place, was brilliant and great, and yeah, they were a mess and what have you. So now we're one of those teams that are needed to be beaten. You know, we the smaller teams will actually change their game plan. Point in case, look at how we've described Sheffield United playing against us. It backfired. Everton are capable of so much more. And like I say, you look at the game up there earlier this season, we got away with a point. You know, hey, it all counts, and it's another point on the scoreboard for us. But, you know, we at that time were not firing on all cylinders. I'd like to think that certainly after the Sheffield United game and B, getting two wingers back, plus there's the small snippets of potential we've seen in Benicio Baker-Boerty, who could
yeah,
come
he'd
on
better
and
do something. I was surprised he didn't come on against Sheffield United with a
so
with
am
this,
I.
Because to be honest, there are going to be fewer spaces on that bench for under 21s with players coming back from injury. I mean, the Hinchelwood injury, you know, is a bit of a setback in a position where we're not the strongest. But in a couple of weeks, you can't see there being much space for Baker-Boerty or you know, any of the other under 21s, unless
Nick, you've just reminded me, and I meant to include this in the Sheffield United review, but the return of Jakub Moda as well, who was magnificent when he came on.
Fair point. But sorry, getting back to yeah, I mean, when you're 5-0 up and cruising, and Adingra has got two goals and probably deserves a standing ovation for, you know, being substituted, then the likes of Baker-Boerty, that's the perfect time to bring him on for a 5-10 minute cameo.
Well, he's had 3 minutes here, 4 minutes. I think there was a chance to give him 15 minutes and actually see what he could do. But as we say, with Fatty's back, there's a, you know, and Ciso will be back at some point, we hope. Those spaces at the bottom of the team list, you know, where Omani and Hinshi and those guys were getting a bit of bench time, I'm afraid that's going to dry up as we get to the sharp end of the season.
But I think that the players are returning. And as you point out, Ada, we've got the draw for the Europa League round of 16, which we've obviously just discussed. But hopefully, provided we don't lose anyone else, which is always a risk, the fact that we're actually getting some of our better players back. Thankfully, like we said at the Sheffield United segment part of this show, Mitoma, despite being, you know, someone trying to maim him, and Adingra, who's only even more recently come back from injury, they looked as though they cruised through the game. So in that sense, you know, none of them had to bust the gut for that game. No. And in that sense, you could say they played a 60-minute game in terms of level of exertion, a level of skill. They were brilliant. So, yeah, we'd like to think that in time for March the 7th, when our next European game is, which is what, it's 2 weeks, 2 and a bit weeks' time, that we're going to get those players back.
Yeah, I know. I'm just looking at the first leg scores here, just thinking, well, you know, I fancy a trip there. But I mean, looking at it, I mean, Milan look like they've pretty much through already. The Sporting Club, the Portugal, Alan.
Yes, there is no such club as Sporting Lisbon.
And Carabag, a trip to Baku is on.
So we could have the old Tesco carrier bag against Carabag.
Indeed. And we'll talk about the draw on next week's show. But thank you first to Nick Trepanic. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been AD Packham, and this has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on a podcast and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week. Cheers. Bye.